listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And let me mute that little microphone there. And we're live at Goddard College, WGDR. And tomorrow I'll be keynoting the Alternative Media Conference here in Plainfield. You can get more information about that at goddard.edu. And we're also live on 91.1 FM in Plainfield, 91.7 FM in Hardwick on Goddard Community College radio, as well as every place else on earth. So, but it's Friday. It's the first hour of Friday. So that means it's time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to be here in Vermont with you. How are you?
You got a nice day, and you're on a beautiful campus.
Indeed, it's true. It's absolutely
true. My wife wanted me to mention that she was president of Goddard, I think back in 1996 and 97, and she worked with the folks at the radio station there.
Oh, wow.
And
okay,
she thought they did a great job. So I
okay, great.
Did want to mention that to them. And also to applaud you for not just coming to Vermont, but for focusing on alternative media. Because I think when we think about the many, many serious problems facing our country, we're not going to successfully grapple with them until we have a significantly expanded alternative media, until we have some impact on corporate media as well. A change does not take place unless we are seriously discussing the most important issues facing our country, and that happens far too rarely. So I applaud the folks there who are coming together to talk about media.
Thank you. Thank you. So what's on your radar screen here, sir?
Let me trickle off some of the issues. There is, the media now is talking a whole lot about the IRS and the IRS monitoring of conservative organizations. No question in my mind that the IRS is dead wrong. You can't treat in this country one group differently than you do the other. What everybody should know, however, is the root cause of this has to do with our absurd campaign finance laws, and in this case specifically the 501c4. And what that is about is allowing private individuals or corporations to pour huge amounts of money into the political process without disclosure. And what the IRS, and this is a congressional problem, should not have been left to the IRS, has to determine how much of that money is going to quote-unquote social welfare, whatever that means, and how much is going into the political process. It is a totally crazy and absurd situation. So I'm here to say that clearly the IRS is wrong. You don't go after one group and not another. Treat everybody equally. But we have got to get at the root of this absurd campaign finance situation, which has everything in the world to do with Citizens United, which has to be overturned, and at the very least, we need a disclosure act so that anyone who makes a sizable contribution into the political process, that person, that corporation is known, and that is not the case. The other issue is dealing with the tracking of phone calls made by AP reporters. Again, to my mind, that is dead wrong. And that takes us back to policies such as the USA Patriot Act, something that I very, very strongly opposed. And the issue here is that terrorism is a serious problem. We want our intelligence agencies to do everything they can to protect the American people. I believe absolutely that we can do that and protect the constitutional rights of the American people, not give government more power than they need. And the key issue here is whether a government agency says, well, you know, I kind of think that this person may have been complicit or involved in some way with terrorism, and therefore we're going to go after them. We're going to track their phone calls. We're going to tap their phones, whatever it may be, get into their emails, rather than going to a third party, i.e. the courts, and saying, you know, judge, we have reason to believe. And the judge says, well, what are your grounds? And the judge says, no, you have no grounds at all, or you're right, go after them. But we need the judiciary involved in that in a much stronger way than the Patriot Act has allowed. So those are some of the issues out there. Now, the other issue that I was on the floor talking about this week is, in fact, the very, very good news, is that according to the Congressional Budget Office, the federal deficit is expected to shrink to $642 billion this year. Now, that's still a lot of money. We still have got to focus on it, on the deficit. But this is much, much less than what had originally been projected. When Obama came in just 5 years ago, we were looking at a deficit of something like $1.4 trillion. We've cut that in half. Now, what does that mean? It means that we still can focus on deficit, but also now is the time to focus on a more important problem, and that is unemployment in the United States of America, which is not at 7.5%, but really close to 14%, some 20 million people who are unemployed. Unemployment rates among kids, people of color, is much, much higher than that. So right now we have reason to celebrate the fact deficit has gone way down, and now it's time to focus on the crises facing the middle class. And what that's about is creating jobs, creating income, decent-paying jobs, making sure that kids can afford to go to college, rebuilding our infrastructure, transforming our energy system. So that's a very important issue. Ironically, Tom, I happen to be on two of the committees that are right now in the midst of dealing with Republican obstructionism. Obama has nominated a fellow named Tom Perez, who I like. I think he's a good guy who can do a good job as Secretary of Labor. What the Republicans are trying to do is to defeat his nomination. There is also a big hullabaloo on that same Health, Education, Labor Committee dealing with the National Labor Relations Board. Without going into all of the issues here, some of our Republican friends would like to see the NLRB cease to function. And if they have fewer than three members, they only have two members, they will not be able to function. And what the NLRB does is protect the rights of workers in terms of collective bargaining. If a company fires a worker who's trying to organize a union, the NLRB provides that recourse. There are laws to protect that worker, but those laws cannot be enforced if the NLRB does not exist. If workers are fired unjustly, the NLRB is there as well. So it seems to me that what Republicans are trying to do in their continuous effort to obstruct any initiative that makes sense to working people is to create a dysfunctional or non-existent NLRB. And five nominees came before the board on Thursday. We've got to get them seated, and we will see what happens. Furthermore, in terms of the EPA, a woman named Gina McCarthy has been nominated by Obama. I think she's a strong nominee. The Republicans have thrown at her over 1,000 questions, boycotted the next-to-last meeting that we had. They were there on Thursday. I think we have approved. We got her out of committee. And now the issue is both with Perez, with the NLRB, with Gina McCarthy, these issues are going to come to the floor. We do not have 60 votes to get any of those issues, any of those people or the NLRB approved. And my strong suggestion, and I've made that to Majority Leader Reid and to others, is that if the Republicans want to continue to obstruct, to make it impossible for workers to get the protection that they need, it's time to change the rules and play by majority rules and have 51 votes needed to pass these very important nominees.
Blow up the filibuster session.
Yeah. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, live, both of us here in Vermont. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders in just a second.
You're
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, just outside of our old stomping grounds in Montpelier. And, of course, Vermont, the home state of U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. Bernie with us taking your calls. And Jim in East Tawas, Michigan. And you were just mentioning Michigan, Bernie. Yep. Jim, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Senator. Bernie, you know, the cap on the Social Security at the $113,000 now, you know, if we just destroyed that completely and just had a flat rate tax, has any experts tried to figure out maybe we could lower it from 6.2% down to maybe 1.5% or 1% if everybody's paying in fair and square? If you make $1 million, pay your 1%. If you make $100, pay your 1%. That's fair and square. Has anybody put that together?
Yes, Jim, actually people have. Let me back up so everybody knows what Jim is talking about. Right now, Social Security, despite what you may see on TV tonight, is not going broke. Social Security has a $2.6 trillion surplus, can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American. And I have been working very, very hard to prevent the Republicans and the President and some Democrats from imposing what is called a chain CPI, which would significantly lower cost of living adjustments over the years, such that if you're 65 today, by the time you are 75, if this so-called chain CPI were to go into effect, you'd be losing about $650 a year. And that is a lot of money for people who are trying to get by on $13,000 or $14,000 a year. Now, the question that Jim is raising is how do we make Social Security strong, not for 20 years, which is currently the case, but for 75 years, which is kind of what the actuaries like to see. They like to see that forecast that far into the future. And Jim is right on. Right now, what everybody should know is that a millionaire will pay into the Social Security Trust Fund the same amount of money as somebody who's making about $113,000. Millionaire will pay the same amount as somebody making $113,000. What Jim is saying is if you lifted the cap, not only would you make Social Security solvent in deep into the future, long into the future, but you could probably lower the rate from 6.2 to lower than that. I don't know that it could be at 1%. You could make it lower. And Jim's idea is a good idea. People have looked at it. They have costed it out. And there are some senators I know who are thinking about that. The other approach, which I am focusing on primarily because it is simpler, if you like, and I want to see something happen right now, is the following. Is by lifting the cap and not even starting at $113,000, but take that bubble up to about $250,000, and then have all taxable income on top of $250,000 taxed. If you do that, Social Security will be strong for at least the next 50 years. So the point here to be made, whatever way you go forward, do what Jim said or doing what I'm saying, is we can make Social Security strong for the indefinite future by focusing on lifting the cap and telling multimillionaires that they're going to help us with the long-term survival of Social Security.
Richard in Carlsbad, California, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're
hey,
on the air, Senator Sanders.
Good.
Tom, Senator Sanders, I want to thank both of you for your lifetime of work for the people.
Thank you.
I'd like your thoughts on an idea that I have about how to lower unemployment and create jobs. If an individual gets laid off, starts collecting unemployment, what if they were able to go to their next employer and say, okay, I can use my unemployment to pay up to half of the new job if you offer it to me?
Well, it's interesting that you raised that, Richard, that idea. And I'll tell you why I find it interesting, because I'm chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, and that is very much the approach that we're trying to develop with regard to making sure that the young men and women who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and in a short period we're going to have 1 million
returning, and unemployment rate is much too high for them. That is exactly what we are, the approach that we're looking for young returning service members. For the general public, I would much prefer that we focus, as I mentioned a moment ago, on creating millions of jobs, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. And you can create jobs at all levels by doing that. Second of all, we can create a whole lot of jobs by starting to focus in a very, very serious way on the planetary crisis of global warming. And that means transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels and into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. So if we are building in this country and servicing and maintaining the wind turbines and the solar systems and the geothermal systems, the biomass systems that we can create, you're going to create a whole lot of jobs. And at the same time, we can, and I'm working on this as a member of the Energy Committee, a major effort toward energy efficiency. We are wasting a huge amount of money in this country, in our homes, in our schools, in our buildings, in terms of wasting just whole huge amounts of energy. And if we can help people get the upfront money that they need to make the retrofits, to save fuel, we not only cut greenhouse gas emissions, we save people money on their fuel bills, and we create jobs. So that's kind of, and the third area that I think we should focus on, and Tom and I have talked about this forever, is trade policy and how we prevent corporations from shutting down in America and moving to China and Vietnam and other low-wage countries. So that would kind of be my general focus on how we create the millions of jobs we need. In terms of veterans, however, the idea that you're talking about is exactly what we're looking at.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us here on our Brunch with Bernie National Town Hall meeting. Bernie taking your calls. Tom Harbin here broadcasting live from Goddard College. Tomorrow I'm keynoting the Alternative Media Conference. You can learn all about that at goddard.edu. And you can get into Senator Sanders' site at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
More of your calls for Bernie right after this. Be sure to check out sanders.senate.gov for the Bernie Buzz. Sign up for it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here live in Plainfield, Vermont on WGDR and among others all over the country. It's Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Sanders taking your call. You're here, Bernie?
Yeah, Tom.
Yeah. Okay, great. Tim in Lincoln Park, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. I wanted to ask Senator Sanders, are you aware of the there was a law that let me start again. I'm sorry. In 1959, the Internal Revenue Service changed the word exclusively to primarily in a campaign finance law dealing with social welfare organizations.
Right.
And ever since, it's applied the word primarily to scrutinize groups that claim that, that are social welfare organizations.
Yes.
That might even explain why today the IRS is accused of targeting right-wing groups, because I don't think it's applying the law correctly. Are you aware of that?
I am. And you're right. And this is why I try to suggest earlier that this is a congressional problem, and clearly while the IRS workers who simply went after right-wing groups was wrong, the problem is that we have a word called primarily. And it gets to the whole absurdity of the current campaign finance situation. Look, here's the bottom line on this. If somebody is contributing or puts a whole lot of money into the political process, should the American people know who those folks are or who those corporations are? And the answer to my mind, I think the overwhelming majority of Americans is, yes, they should. But what you'd have now is this very complicated system, which involves these so-called 501c4s, which is where this scandal is now located. And that is that people are putting their money into a 501c4, which is supposed to be primarily social welfare. Well, Karl Rove and other political operatives are not putting money into these organizations in order to feed the poor or house the homeless. These are strictly for political purposes. And it's a means by which you can make
political contributions in secret. And the caller is absolutely right. What we need to do is clarify this situation. If you're going to be involved in politics, it has nothing to do with social welfare, and that's fine, but we have to know who you are. In my view, even more important, we have to eliminate the ability of anybody in America, whether you're progressive, conservative, or whatever, from making these outrageously large contributions and buying elections, which leads us then to the need to overturn Citizens United and move to public funding of elections. But the caller is absolutely right in what he said.
Okay. Jason in Arlington, Virginia, listening on Sirius. Hey, Jason, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, I'm so glad that you're talking about the unemployment rate, because I'm kind of fed up with the fact that everybody's trying to cheer about these numbers being in the, you know, single digits, when the truth is, obviously, it's at that 14% level that you were referring to. So I want to compliment you on that. The big thing that's standing out in my mind is, at this point right now, you know, we had this big discussion about guns and dropping the number of gun deaths. And the single biggest way of dropping the number of gun deaths in the United States would be to decriminalize drugs, because the number one way people are killing themselves, aside from suicide, is inner city drug type of transactions or killings. And I don't know why we're not focusing in on this, because there's a huge cost savings. We've got this whole prison complex going on here. We're taking the rights away from millions of Americans for something as simple as a drug that the last two presidents, if they had gotten caught, probably wouldn't have been president.
Well, James, I think you make a good point. I can tell you that the Vermont State Legislature, and they're certainly not alone, just recently passed legislation, as I understand it, would decriminalize possession of a small amount of marijuana. And I think you're going to see that trend increasing all over the country. I think your point is right, that we are spending a lot of money and destroying a lot of lives by putting people who have not been involved in violent crime behind bars. So I think we have to rethink in a very significant way the entire war on drugs. So.
Okay. Gary in Evanston, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Gary, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, how are you today?
Good.
So I agree with you. I'm sorry, I'm off the speakerphone. I agree with you about raising the cap on the Social Security, especially for people who are making a big amount of money. However, you know, there's a matching cap as a business. And as a businessman, if I can pay the money, and I'm willing to, but for the business, if I have to match all that, that is a lot of money, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Well, you make a good point. And I think that right now my focus is on individuals who have the ability to pay more. And that's where I think we should be focused.
Phil in Frankenville, New Jersey. Phil, you're on the air for Senator Sanders.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Hey, Mr. Sanders, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, Mr. Sanders, I have two questions. One is, how come they're making a big fuss about the IRS, you know, going after these groups? But when they went, IRS went after the NAACP and National Action Network, you know what I mean? It was okay. And my second question is that why are they always saying that the American people want this and want that, but yet the Republicans don't do what the American people want? So why don't they just get them a new saying that the American people they represent are the rich?
Well, I think you raised two good points. To the best of my knowledge, I don't have that paper in front of me. You are right in that in the past, we have seen the kind of abuse that we are seeing now. Now it's been going after conservative groups, but it has gone after liberal groups like the NAACP, who have also been audited. The bottom line there clearly is that IRS policy has got to be neutral. It's got to be across the board, and you don't go after liberal groups or conservative groups. Treat all groups the same. But I think the caller is right in saying that in years past, there has been concern about groups like the NAACP being audited. His second question is, Republicans Republicans talk about representing all of the people when in fact they end up representing the very wealthy. And I think that's exactly the correct. You know, what is very interesting, Tom, is the issues that you and I talk about economic justice, about creating jobs, about a fair tax policy, about protecting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. These are not just ideas that you and I agree on or some of our callers agree on. These are ideas that poll after poll after poll, the American people agree with us on. So if you ask the American people, would you rather see taxes being raised for upper income people or cuts in Social Security and Medicare, the answer is just overwhelming in terms of protecting Social Security and Medicare. It is very distressing to me how rarely Congress is actually listening to the American people. Even in the issue of deficit reduction, which I believe is an important issue, compared to job creation, you know what the American people say? Spend more time making sure that we have jobs in this country. That's a higher priority than deficit reduction. Clearly in the current Congress, especially among the Republicans, it is not a priority at all. So I think the caller makes a very important point.
Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Danette, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. I actually have to go. My daughter is having a nosebleed. So,
oh, my. Okay.
Thank you so much. Yes, thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Danette. All right, let's go to Daniel in Dallas, Texas.
This is real life, right?
Yeah, this is real life. It really is.
Kids have nosebleeds.
Live radio and TV. Daniel in Dallas, Texas. You're on the air with Senator. You're on the air with Bernie.
I appreciate the opportunity. Senator Sanders, I wonder if you could speak on Elizabeth Warren's bill to lower student loan rates to 0.75%, the same rate that the insolvent zombie banks are borrowing at the Fed's discount window. This seems to be a profoundly amazing idea, not only because it'll offer relief to students who are taking out New Stafford loans, but also it forces the Federal Reserve to begin lending to the American people rather than to just the banks. So I wonder if you could speak on that bill.
Well, Daniel, the only thing that gets me upset about this legislation is that Elizabeth thought of it and I didn't. That's my only concern. It's a great idea for the reason you've just mentioned. In fact, we had talked about it in my office a while ago, and Elizabeth did exactly the right thing. And it makes two points. First of all, I could tell you what you already know, that the issue of student loans nationally is a very, very serious problem. All over this country, we're seeing young people deciding not to go to college because they don't want to come out of school, you know, $40,000 or $50,000 in debt. In the state of Vermont, kids are coming out of college about $28,000 in debt, which is just a hair higher than the national average. And this is an awful problem. And I think what Senator Warren's legislation does is does two things. Number one, it's going to protect working families and make sure that they don't come out of debt. Don't come out of school so deeply in debt. And second of all, it does raise the question that Daniel just asked. How is it that large financial institutions can borrow money for 1% or whatever it is, while students have got to borrow money at many, many, many times that rate? So I think Senator Warren's idea is an excellent idea, and I look forward to working with her to make that fight.
Bravo. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, here on the Tom Hartman Program, taking your calls for Bernie, and live from Goddard College. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
For more about the conference that I'm speaking at here at Goddard, check out goddard.edu and to subscribe to sign up for the Bernie Buzz, Bernie's newsletter, go to sanders.senate.gov. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, our National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, and Ethan in New York City, New York, New York. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Hello.
You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just listening to your callers, and I mean, I pretty much gathered up a lot of that. I came with one question, but I gathered up with a lot of things I wanted to say. But first thing is the black unemployment you were talking about, how the unemployment numbers in the black community is all under, no matter which president we have, unemployment in the black community is going to be high.
Yep.
My thing is, what can a politician or anybody do to make, you know, employers hire more black people? Because my community is really hurting out there, no matter what the numbers are. And no one wants to really talk about that. No one wants to bring that question up. You know, I watch MSNBC all the time. You know Fox News isn't going to say anything about it.
Right.
But no one is going to, you know, no one brings that up. And another thing, the other question, it was not really a question, but this whole thing about the drug war and all this other stuff about people trying to legalize marijuana, like the gun thing, these people don't come to the ghettos to see what, you know, what marijuana is doing to our young people. No one is coming to the black neighborhoods to see what it's doing to our young people, and they want to talk about legalizing it because they just want to get high. You know, I've heard that they have marijuana in pill form now, so there's no excuse anymore for them to try to legalize it. My thing is, don't legalize it, but do what they did with cigarettes. Well, not necessarily with cigarettes, but completely don't try to arrest people that have weed on them anymore. Just fine them. High fines. That way, you know, if they have a weed on them, just give them a big, like a $2,000 fine for every bag of weed they have on them. That'll stop people from smoking it.
Yeah.
You know, and
I think there's a, in terms of your last point, there is a movement in that direction. And one of the reasons for that is that states can no longer afford to be locking up large numbers of people who were found guilty of possessing drugs. So it becomes an economic issue for states. The second point in terms of black unemployment, the point that I was making is unemployment in the nation is much, much too high. But there are certain groups of people, young people in general, African-American and minority groups in general, the numbers are much, much higher. And we have got to focus on those types of communities and create jobs. You will recall that some years ago we used to have something that I thought was very useful. It worked in Vermont and it worked all over the country. And that is summer youth employment programs. Republicans killed that effort. And that means in the summertime you're going to have a whole lot of kids sitting around with nothing to do, not earning any income, and probably in some cases getting themselves into trouble. So we're going to be working with some other senators on a youth employment bill, figuring out ways that we can make sure that kids are earning some income, doing something meaningful, learning some skills. And I think in the long run, that concept will pay for itself many times over.
John, in Corning, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, Mr. Sanders. I was just curious about what your thoughts are and what you're doing about people 55 and older and these companies not hiring them. I just watched a program, or when I actually was on PBS, they ran a thing, I think it was on May 3rd, about it. It's, and I forget what the numbers were, but it was quite alarming.
It is, John. And what you got going there is, it is no great secret. I didn't see the program, but I know the issue. And the issue is that if you have worked for a company for 20 or 30 years, you're going to be making more money than other people in the company. Especially also when you retire, I mean, you may be eligible for some retirement benefits. And it is no great secret that some unscrupulous companies all over this country are firing people who are 55, hiring people who are 23 at half the wages. Companies save substantial sums of money. Now, as a matter of fact, that's against the law. It's called, discrimination. We have laws to protect older workers, but sometimes companies are able to get around those laws. So, number one, we have to enforce, the law, against age discrimination. That's about all that I can say on that. It is a real, real tragedy, because if you have somebody who's 55 who loses a decent paying job, there is a strong likelihood that individual will never again find a job paying anywhere near the income that he or she is currently earning. And they will maybe find another job at half the income, and that's a terrible way to end one's work life.
Yeah. Bernie, just 2 minutes left. We could possibly squeeze in a call, or you could give us your thoughts on the week.
Well, there's going to be a lot of action next week. In the Senate. The ag bill is coming to the floor. Senator Stabenow of Michigan is chairman of the Ag Committee, and against very difficult odds, she has produced the bill, and that's not as strong as any of us would like, because you got to deal with Republicans here, but she got a good vote out of the committee. It'll come to the floor. One of the issues that I will focus, there are a couple of issues that we'll be working on. We're going to try, in the bill, she had to make some cuts in the food stamp program, much, much less than what the Republicans in the House wanted to do. They want to make devastating cuts. But I think at a time when unemployment is so high and poverty is so high, we don't want to see an increase in hunger in America, so we'll try to deal with that issue. The second issue deals with genetically modified food. As you know, Tom, throughout Europe, the countries in Europe make sure that people have labeling which will identify food products that are genetically modified. I think we should at least allow states in this country to do the same, and right now that is not the case. Last year I offered an amendment on that issue, and this year I will do the same. That's coming up next week. I suspect, not 100% sure, that not long after that, the immigration bill will be coming up. That's a huge bill, worthy of a lot more discussion than we can do right now. But one of the things that concerns me are the guest worker programs that could bring in just hundreds of thousands of foreign workers into this country at a time when unemployment here is much too high. So that's an issue we have to focus on as well.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, my pleasure. And welcome back to Vermont, I should say.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Goddard College, where this weekend, tomorrow, we're going to be Ellen Ratner and I. I'm giving the keynote speech. She's closing the conference. Andy Zeiser, Ann Galloway, Maxie Jackson, Todd O'Boyle, the Video Freaks. It's going to be a fantastic time tomorrow. You can get information about it at goddard.edu. It's the Alternative Media Conference at Goddard College here, which also is carrying us live on WGDR, as well as, of course, every place else on Earth. So, John W. Dean is with us. Speaking of great minds, we do this Conversations with Great Minds thing on our TV show. I have always thought of John Dean as one of the great minds of our era, certainly of my lifetime.
He doesn't know where Goddard College is. Where is it?
We're in Plainfield, Vermont. Thank you for prompting me.
All right.
Near Montpelier, Vermont.
Great.
And thank you so much for being with us today. I should say, by the way, the author of numerous books, including most recently Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. And your columns can be found at verdict.justica.com, and we have those links over at tomhartman.com. You were involved in, of course, the Watergate scandal. You worked in the Nixon administration, the Nixon White House. And, in fact, we're the first to identify what the phrase that you used was a cancer on the presidency. There has been all this bloviating going on the right about how this is a scandal worse than Watergate. What say you?
It certainly shows a lack of historical knowledge. That's all I can say. In fact, some who know better are even claiming it is of Watergate ilk. And they're obviously playing that Nixon card for pure political reasons. It is right. Not even close to Watergate by any definition. When you take in the trifecta, if you will, of scandals that Obama's confronted with, take first Benghazi. That, to me, is a scandal looking for some underlying wrongdoing. It's a travesty and a tragedy what happened there because of terrorism. It's not something people can take blame for, because you can never deal with that problem. They're going to pop up anywhere and everywhere.
The complaint is somehow about the aftermath and how it was described, when it was described, the fact that the military wasn't apparently instantly on the scene to deal with the problem. A lot of second guessing, a lot of confused finger pointing, and it really is a scandal that no one can understand what in the hell the Republicans are complaining about. It's just so that one, I don't see having really very long and strong legs. People are eventually going to tire of the Republican smoke machine that's trying to make more out of this issue than it really is. So that one I don't think will last. The IRS, where there were hearings today, and they brought the acting commissioner forward, clearly there were mistakes made. Even those involved acknowledge that. Targeting right-wingers for tax exemptions, obviously they didn't do it with any sophistication. They were overwhelmed after the Citizens United decision with applications. It went up to something like 70,000 applications, and they're underpaid, understaffed, and they were looking for shortcuts, and they weren't very prudent in how they looked for them, in using word searches and what have you to find things, and it blew up. It's a bureaucratic, low-level, middle-level management problem, and not a White House scandal of any way, shape, or form. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, you were the White House counsel in the Nixon administration, which, if I understand that position right, is essentially the lawyer to the president.
No, actually, that's what people long thought, and that's what I thought at the time. That is not really correct. Post-Watergate, that's been clarified. White House counsel, his client is the office of the president, not the particular person who's in the office.
Oh, that's interesting. So when you described the cancer on the presidency, you were actually really doing what the White House counsel should do, which is advising how the office is being besmirched by the individual in that office.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But as far as Obama's counsel, there are reports that she received advance warning. I don't know that it's the sort of thing that you could anticipate what indeed happened when it leaked out because of Lois Lerner, who is the middle-level tax person who started this all off back on May 10th, when she was talking to the American Bar Association meeting, their tax section meeting in Washington, and got a question about the exemption process and procedure. And at that point, she maybe in anticipation of the Inspector General's report being critical of it, addressed the fact that the mistakes had been made. And this sort of just erupted into an instant scandal within hours of her sharing that information with the tax section of the ABA. I don't know what internal procedures or how early the White House counsel had been alerted to this. White House counsel learn of these things all the time. There's really not much you can do about it. All you're told the Inspector General that office of Inspector General throughout the government is a post-Watergate reform. Before that, the General Counsel might often inform the White House of something. For example, in my tenure, we had advance warning about Mili and that whole problem. One of the things that I think was actually handled better by the Nixon administration than many issues. I don't think she probably reported that to the president. And then he learned it, of course, from the news when it broke that Friday.
Right. So what do you think if these aren't genuinely scandals, if these don't elevate themselves to the office of the presidency, if these, each one of these things, and now we're finding
the
Benghazi
ones. The AP phone records, that hasn't even gone as high as the Attorney General. Decision was made, and that's really a policy dispute, not a scandal. It's that the news media understandably does not like to be investigated. and be targeted for leaks. They are not being targeted, but rather they're being targeted to try to determine who their sources are. What is not happening is they're not being hauled in front of grand juries and demanding that they release their sources or be in contempt of court. This is always a balance because no president can govern in a fishbowl, particularly in the national security area. So you just can't have federal employees who promised not to release classified information releasing classified information. Otherwise, you can't really function. So it's a tough question. Did they overreach? I don't know. I don't think so, from what I gather. Because particularly when they so much further they could have gone, like hauling the reporters in and saying, "All right, who told you this?" So it's sort of a middle ground they've taken, and they're getting banged for even taking that.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. We just have maybe 15, 20 seconds left. I'm sorry. Is there a real scandal that you wanted to point to?
The scandal might be the fact that these are scandals.
Well, CBS is reporting now that the Republicans apparently altered the White House emails.
That would not surprise me. That'd be standard procedure for them, Tom.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. John W. Dean, former White House counsel in the Nixon administration, author of numerous and brilliant books. Conservatives Without a Conscience is one of my favorites. Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. John Dean, thank you for being with us.
Be well, Tom.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting live from Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont. We'll be back in just a moment with Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Goddard College, where we will tomorrow be doing the Alternative Media Conference. I'll be keynoting it at 9 o'clock in the morning, and you can get more information about that at goddard.edu. But it's Anything Goes Friday, so let's pick up your calls. Marie in Henderson, Nevada. Hey, Marie, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hi Tom, how are you? I'm calling from Vegas, Nevada. I just come into the car and I heard Senator Sanders talking about the bill about getting kids employed during the summer.
Needing jobs for young people?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So I'm calling about that one. Well, I'm an economist from Europe, and like macroeconomist, I can tell you this much, that there is lots of way to solve unemployment, but hiring kids is not the one. And I do love Senator Sanders, and I wish he doesn't push it with that bill, because...
So are you suggesting hiring adults or hiring... by kids, I think mostly what they're, you know, what Bernie's talking about is not 16-year-olds. He's talking about people in there between 20 and 30, you know, people who have just graduated from college.
Well, that's another point.
Those are adults in my mind.
Yes, well, they're adults, but they're not having a family. What I'm talking about is the people who need a job under this high unemployment that we're running right now, and which is much more than 15%. The lack of unemployment in agriculture is way beyond that. Numbers.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
We can solve unemployment by patchwork bills that gonna solve some summer jobs or something like that. We need.
So what's your solution?
Structural change. What I'm talking about is a structural change that we need to start thinking about it, which is instead of 8 hours workday, we need 6 hours workday. And the last time when
France did.
Yes, when we adjust last time we adjust productivity with the workday of the labor was 1938. Well, productivity went so much higher than 1938, and it's time to adjust that because there is no way that we can hire the people each year. We got demographic tendency that we can't even match up them. You know, young people coming to the labor market, and then the productivity is much higher, and corporate America will not hire people when they can do the same job with less labor.
Right. No, I got it. Marie, you made your point very well. Thank you very much. I need to get some more calls in here. Thank you, though, for calling in. I appreciate it. James in Hasty, Arkansas. Hey, James, thanks for watching. What's up?
Hi. How you doing, Tom?
I'm great.
I'd like to let you and the rest of America know about this hog farm they're putting in on the Buffalo River.
And in Arkansas?
About that? Yes, sir.
No, I haven't heard about it. Tell us about
it. The river of the United States. And the USDA has given a $3 million loan to these people, and they've installed this 6,500 pig hog farm, and they didn't even contact or tell the local communities around here. And it's on Big Creek, which is five and a half miles from the Buffalo.
Hmm.
They're only testing the water every 3 months. So if they have any pollution, by the time they test it, it'll be all the way down to Buffalo. We got over 300 species of fish and insects down here. And they considered none of that when they went in and done their evaluation for the hog farm.
Mm-hmm.
We was really wanting to know if we could get some help from everybody that we could do about this. Because they're really, I mean, if we have a flood down here, they've got a 2 million gallon waste pond where the pig waste goes.
Right. James, have you talked with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund? Do you know about CELDEF, CELDEF.org?
No, I hadn't got with him. I've got with everybody else, I guess, but
well,
him.
Well, write this down. There's a lawyer by the name of Thomas Lindsay, and I think there's a D in there, L-I-N-D-S-E-Y, and, or maybe S-A-Y, but in any case, Thomas Lindsay, and the organization is called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And their website is CELDF, as in Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, .org. And they help individual communities. They'll get a call from somebody like you, and they'll get together the people in the local community and the elected officials in particular, and help them pass laws banning this kind of thing. And they've had incredible successes. They've got communities all over the country that have successfully fought off, in particular, things like these giant hog farms. And, so, you know, give them a call and see what they have to say. Do you know what's been done so far to try and stop this? Or is this a fiat accompli? Has this already been, have they already started the construction?
It's already opened up. They didn't even let the general public around here know until they had already got pigs in the facility. Group has got together and filed a lawsuit against the USDA, but that's as far as it's went so far with the matters of the courts, you know, and we get floods more than we get court results.
That's incredible. Is it owned by a local company or by a national company?
Well, it's a bad thing, sir, and we just need a little help. I appreciate
the
information. I will use it.
Okay. Thanks a lot, James. Thanks for the call. We're just about 30 seconds out from the break, so we'll pick up other calls as we come back from that break. Thomas Lindsay. I've met Thomas Lindsay. There's a movie being made about him right now, by the way, and the work that he's doing. It's going to be really great. And I've known him for over a decade. He does absolutely awesome work. And he's been on this program a number of times for those of you who are longtime watchers or listeners. And the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is one of those really, really great organizations that doesn't get anywhere near the press they should. CELDF, F like in Frank, or like fund.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're live from Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, and at goddard.edu. We'll be back right after this. It's the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting today from Goddard College, WGDR, in Plainfield, Vermont, where tomorrow I will be the keynote speaker at the Alternative Media Conference, taking place all day on the campus of Goddard College. And if you are within sound range of my voice, you could be in range of my voice anywhere in the world. But if I were to stand outside and shout, in any case, drop by tomorrow if you're in the Vermont area. It should be a lot of fun. It's going to be very, very interesting. Vahid, who listens to us on KPFK, our Pacifica affiliate in Los Angeles. Hey, Vahid.
What's up? Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine. Same thing goes Friday. What's on your mind?
Okay, I wrote you an email. Actually, I wrote it to Louise at Hartman. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you got that email that I had written.
I don't know.
Okay, it's a motor renewable, and it's the lowest cost power provider. Mm-hmm. Essentially, most of the calls that came in regarding the environment, I think it's sort of, especially 400 parts per million is a thing that could be reversed even if you start to use mm-hmm. these motors.
Okay. So where can people find out more about these motors?
Well, so far, not. I was trying to go out for Mr. Sanders. I don't have a patent.
Is there a website or is there a...
No. It's just what I've written you about the motor is in those emails.
I see.
But what it is the question I had for Mr. Sanders is also this motor can be used. The biggest application I saw, which is immediate, is in case of the flood as it happened in New York City. It also can be used to generate the power as the fuel was out. So the motor generates its own power.
Vahida, I would encourage you to share this with the world. I mean, you know, put a blog up someplace. You can create a free blog over at tomhartman.com if you want. There's a lot of other places as well.
The question for Mr. Sanders was, since it also has an emergency preparedness aspect to it, it can be used for disaster mitigation in a way. Even in the case if the flooding is in the Midwest and Michigan and so forth would have been bad, it could have been used to remove the water quickly. In the next few months, we get into the season. I can at least present it to some of the officers in PTO. And by that way, the government would immediately know that this is the real thing. Secondly,
PTO being the patent office.
Pardon me?
PTO being the patent office.
Yes.
Patent and trade office. Yeah.
That's what I was trying to ask him, that is, if it could be done. So in the next few months, you would have ability to confront the storms. Yeah.
I don't know, and I'm quite sure that Bernie would probably refer you to the patent and trademark office as well. Although this is, you know, bringing a new product to the marketplace that has to do with alternative energies. There's a lot of people out there. There are, you know, venture capital funds that are looking for new products. There are entrepreneurs who are looking for new products. Louise and I had dinner last night with a fellow here in Vermont who's a real leader in alternative power in this state. So, you know, there are resources out there. I'm not your channel to those resources. I'm not a lawyer, a patent lawyer or anything like that. And don't do those kind of things. So I would suggest that if you're the inventor, that you hire a patent lawyer and patent the thing, or find a venture capitalist or somebody who wants to fund it, who would fund that process in exchange for probably a piece of the action. But it's really much more than that. I'm really in over my head, Vahid. I'm sorry. But thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing, and I wish you the very, very best. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment about a previous caller you had calling up about the Buffalo National River. That's the nation's first wild and scenic river back in the early 70s. They made it so. And it is a wonderful place. It's like a little Grand Canyon in the upper levels of the Ozark Mountains. And it is, as far as I know, it would be completely against the law for that hog farm to be operational in that watershed. And Big Creek is a big creek. Mm-hmm. It pushes a lot of water down there. That's real bad news. And if it's that difficult for the federal government to enforce what's already on the books about keeping these polluters out of the watersheds of our national scenic rivers, why, just imagine how hard it's going to be for that poor fellow to get that machine, fixed up and going.
Yeah.
So I'm just...
Yeah, I,
There's a lot going wrong out here that people just aren't aware of how bad it is with the environment and how roughshod these Republicans, this petrol monopoly, how roughshod they're running all over our country.
Yeah. Well, this is why I keep saying we no longer live in a constitutionally limited democratic republic. We now live in a constitutional monarchy. The nine justices of the Supreme Court have set themselves up as the kings and queens of America to decide what is law, what isn't law. And one of the things that they have invented as a law, it was never proposed by any legislature or any president. In fact, numerous presidents have spoken out against it, including President Obama. In fact, in the State of the Union address that he spoke out against it, is this idea that corporations are people and money is speech. And that is what has empowered these big ag companies to set up these giant factory farms and places that just devastate local watersheds. And it's what prevents, and it's one of the reasons why they can buy off legislators, you know, why the Republican Party won't appropriately fund the USDA and at the EPA and other agencies. I mean, it's just, we have seen both regulatory capture and governmental capture by big business and basically capture of our democratic process by big business. We need to take back democracy in the United States and declare that money is not speech and that corporations are not people. And once that is done, then, you know, local legislatures can pass laws that will stop this kind of thing. But nothing's going to happen, or very little is going to happen, until that's done. And that's why I encourage people to go to movetoamend.org and join the movement to amend the Constitution to say, you know, no, the Supreme Court was wrong in this 100-year-long doctrine that they've been building slowly and steadily of corporations as people and money as speech, and we're going to undo that. So, Bob, thanks for the call. Mark in Chicago. Let's see, on WCPT.
Hi.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, how you doing? Hey,
good.
I wanted to disagree with you on a thing you said last week, and that was you believe that that society can't be, there can be no society without hierarchy.
No, I don't believe that.
No?
No. In fact, the Native American societies, among others, but, I mean, Peter Farb's brilliant book, Man's Rise to Civilization, where he documents, I think, 38 different Native American tribes at point of first contact with Europeans, how their cultures worked. What you found was that in virtually all of these societies, if there were people who were identified as leaders like chiefs, they were actually the lowest in terms of power in the community typically and the highest in responsibility. It was a great burden that they took. These were largely horizontal societies. And I think that the history of the human race being 160,000 years old and the history of modern civilization being only 7,000 years old, this idea of creating kings and warlords and theocrats that came along with Gilgamesh and you know the first city states and you know patriarchy and monarchy and the whole thing, I think that's the aberration in human history, not the norm. I think that what we are living in is a dysfunctional society, not a normal society.
Right. I saw a documentary about the Australian Aboriginals, which said the same thing. African historians say, you know, they say something. Actually, it's when you are at a certain level of technology, you tend not to have hierarchy and you tend not to have private property. So anyway, I would refer you to a good book about it called Consensus by Peter Gelderoos. So
okay,
kind of lays it out. Yeah,
it's about consensus societies.
It's about actually consensus decision making. It's kind of a, right. You know, kind of a book that's kind of hopeful about us going back to something like that. You know, it was written by the introduction is by one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs. You know, it's kind of like a modern anarchist kind of a thing.
Yeah. So. Back in the late 90s, my books on attention deficit disorder were getting a lot of attention, and Time magazine had done a story about them, and quack quack quack. Don Morin was the premier of what was then the Northwest Territories. It's now been split in two, but it was basically all of northern Canada. And he invited me up to Yellowknife and on the Great Slave Lake and to basically run a weekend-long conference. And he flew in Native people from all over Canada or all over the Northwest Territories. We had about 350 different tribal elders essentially there, to talk about how to create schools that worked. And just anecdotal that, we did that over the weekend, and then Monday he took Louise and I into Yellowknife to meet with the MLA, the Something Legislative Assembly, which was the, you know, their version of the state legislature. And they sit in a circle, and it is the only consensus legislature in the Americas, as far as I know. There may be other ones in the world, but any one person could veto anything. It required complete consensus, and it was really quite a remarkable experience. And Don Warren is an amazing man. Mark, thanks for the heads up on the book and the information. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I guess my point on that personal story was that if, you know, one of the provinces of Canada can do it, it can be done, and it does work. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So I'm in Vermont today. You're in Washington, D.C. What's going on in the belly of the beast and all around the world?
Oh, beastly stuff. Representative Daryl Issa issued a subpoena today for Ambassador Thomas Pickering to sit for a taped interview, but not to testify publicly before the full House Oversight Committee about his report that he co-wrote with former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, on Benghazi.
Right. And Daryl Issa presumably does not want this to be public testimony because what Pickering would say is, Congressman Issa, have you no shame? There is no there there.
Well, basically, Issa has very publicly attacked the findings in the report, and Pickering has said that he wants to publicly respond in committee, and they actually had a big clash on the Sunday shows last week. They were on the same Sunday show at the same time and had a fight. I mean, it was a real fight. This doesn't very often happen, and Pickering, you know, said, I want to come on, I want to testify, and so Issa basically said, well, yes, he could come on, but he wanted him to testify behind closed doors first. And Pickering very publicly this week, and Admiral Mike Mullen also, was saying, but Pickering's taken the lead on this, saying, no, you have publicly and liberally discredited us and our report. We wish to publicly testify about it. So today, Issa's issued a subpoena for him to sit for a taped interview behind closed doors.
In other words, ISIS said, no way, and, you know, we're going to take your testimony. No one else is going to hear it except us.
Right. And so Elijah Cummings, who's the ranking member, Democrat from Maryland, is livid.
Yeah. Well, do the Democrats on that committee have the power to do anything, or does Daryl Issa have basically kingly powers or princely powers?
He has kingly powers. He's not one of the richest, as we all know. Carl Arms, wasn't it, I think, or something? Was it Carl Arms?
Yeah. I'm not sure who's the... I think Daryl Issa is the second richest man in the House of Representatives.
Yes, he is. He is. But he's one of the most powerful members of Congress now with all these investigations going on because he has the Oversight Committee. And so this is really quite an extraordinary step to... I mean, there are people who you can subpoena and say, yeah, I subpoena Victoria Jones, whatever. To subpoena, he's one of the most respected people in Washington, D.C.
Give us a quick recap of who Thomas Pickering is.
Thomas Pickering, I mean, I'm not very good on these things, but he's a former ambassador.
Right.
And a respected ambassador. He's not like, he was an ambassador, but he didn't do very much. He was a former ambassador who's respected both sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
Everybody said he's a serious guy. Going to write this report, this is the person you want to do it because he can't be bought.
And wasn't he a Republican? Wasn't
I'm
he an
sure
ambassador
what,
who was appointed
I'm not
by a Republican
sure
president?
What party he belonged to.
Yeah, okay.
Not
all right.
Sure.
Moving along,
I will touch briefly on the first IRS hearing. There are two more next week, one of which will be in Daryl Issa's committee. This
of course.
House Ways and Means.
we had the J. Russell George, the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, who told House Ways and Means Committee members that basically that the IRS was messed up, and but he didn't say that it was politically motivated. We also had really some very, very strong language coming from House Republicans and some partisan jousting, and House Republicans going very strongly to widen this inquiry beyond just the IRS targeting, and he didn't they didn't like the word targeting of Tea Party groups. They were also testifying with Stephen Miller, who has just retired, quote-unquote, as the acting commissioner of the IRS. He made a very poor witness, actually. He didn't do himself any favors as a witness, but he also was hammered for 4 hours by Republicans and also by Democrats, who played a slightly different role because they were not going after Obama. But Dave Kemp, the chair of the committee, opened up the hearings by saying that this was all about cover-ups before the hearing even started. So that's where this all is going. This is all going about cover-ups, and this is all going to be broadened far beyond the IRS. They're going to go.
Right. In other words, all of these are attempts to take down the Obama administration, specifically President Obama. And if they can get former Secretary of State Clinton in the process, that's a twofer.
Yes. Meantime, President Obama today went to Baltimore and announced that he signed a new executive order. He spoke at a dredging equipment manufacturing plant, and he's on a jobs tour. Jobs. Something.
That's great.
You know,
that's what we should be talking about. We've got 14 million people who are unemployed or underemployed in the United States. Arguably, if you include a more broad definition of underemployed, 20-25 million people in this country, working minimum wage jobs and things or below their job skills. And it's a national scandal for the richest country in the world to be like this.
And he didn't make that point, but he did make the point that sometimes our leadership isn't focused where it needs to be focused, he said. Urging those in attendance to tell the people in Washington to focus on getting stuff done. And he signed a new executive order designed to halve the amount of red tape involved in infrastructure construction projects. And basically it will mean that federal agencies implement so-called best practices to streamline the process for getting federal permits to work on infrastructure projects. So he was pretty excited about that. He also
Go ahead.
I was going to say, he also visited an elementary school and drew a tiger, and he said that the kids were totally unimpressed.
Really?
Yeah.
It's hard to impress kids, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Doesn't always work.
Yes. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Owen Ratner's little charity that is just the little engine that could. Victoria Jones, thank you for the report today.
Thank you.
It is always so nice to hear your voice on our air. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday. Your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. We are broadcasting live today from the studios of WGDR, the radio station associated with Goddard College, a 150-year anniversary that they're celebrating, or they were, maybe earlier in the year. That's amazing, isn't it? 1862 to 2013, or 1863 to 2013, 150 years. That's amazing. Anyhow, tomorrow I'm going to be keynoting the Alternative Media Conference here at Goddard, and for more information on that, this is in Plainfield, Vermont. When we had John Dean on earlier, I mentioned this, and he goes, oh, where's Goddard? Okay, Plainfield, Vermont. Near Montpelier, Vermont, where Louise and I used to live, and in fact, where we started this radio show. We started this radio show literally out of our living room in Montpelier, Vermont. We built a studio, or my office, actually, off the living room, the library. and Andy Zeiser is going to be there, Ann Galloway, Maxie Jackson, Todd O'Boyle, the Video Freaks, and Ellen Ratner is going to wrap the thing up. Its evening program includes radical puppetry, guerrilla theater, and hacktivist media, and interactive performances curated by Vermont artist Ben Matchstick. Ben T. Matchstick. And Ben T. I get it. And you can learn more about it at goddard.edu. It should be a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to it. You can check it out on the web, too. If you're not in Vermont. And if you're not in Vermont, you're missing out on some great weather. It's Anything Goes Friday, so let's pick up your calls here. Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, Danette, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Sure. Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was actually just trying to get clarity, and I think your guest clarified the issues with the IRS. I realize that it's not really a scandal, but something that's not really been addressed in the media, at least, and maybe not even in the hearings that they're having, is the fact that, like in your news report that was just played in between the show, is that a lot of things are not, the Republicans are stalling on nearly everything to, you know, in an effort for President Obama to fail. And part of the problem with the IRS is that they're understaffed and they have an influx of applications. What I'm wondering is if the targeting that was being done wasn't necessarily malicious, but really they were just trying to do their jobs in determining whether or not they had filed the right status or whether they were even supposed to, you know, the whole process, the whole point of submitting an application to the IRS for 501 status, whether it's 501c4 or C3 or 27 or whatever the numbers are that they use for, you know, tax
for nonprofit status.
Yeah, for nonprofit status, there's a process that you go through for a reason, because not just anybody can be a not considered a nonprofit organization. So isn't the issue and the bigger scandal, like you've been talking about, that corporations are now people and anybody can pretty much do this and pretend like they're some sort of social program when they're really not? What they really are is the political arm of the right wing or the left wing or whatever, whoever's doing it, it shouldn't be done. And I think that's what I was trying to get clarification on.
Yes, I'm totally with you, Danette. And I mentioned this a couple days ago. Louise and I, in 1978, started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire. It's still there, SalemChildren'sVillage.org and HunterSchool.org are the websites if you're looking for a good charity. And as a nonprofit, you can make a tax-deductible contribution to them. And these, I think that, and I personally wrote the IRS application or helped write the application. I had some friends who helped, so there were a couple of us who put this thing together. But I was involved in the process of writing this application and wrote much of the language myself. And I can tell you, that, you know, we were and are, continue to be, a genuine social welfare organization. We're 501c3. We're actually just, you know, there's no politics involved at all in any way under any circumstances. No lobbying, no running TV ads, no nothing. I mean, it's just caring for, you know, kids who are either severely abused or have very, really severe learning disabilities, autism, Asperger's, ADHD. And that still took us a year to get our approval. But once you submit your application to the IRS, you can begin operating as a nonprofit and take tax deductible contributions immediately and while you're waiting for the IRS to approve it. And typically they do approve it. And so I don't think that there's much evidence that any of these Tea Party groups were harmed. Other than just, you know, they slowed down a little bit. The code, the law, it's 501, you know, section 501 of the tax law, and that C4 paragraph specifies that the organization must be exclusively social welfare. And the IRS has interpreted that law in their regulations to say primarily, and thus Karl Rove interpreted the word primarily to be 51% social welfare. So he says, okay, 51% of what we talk about is, you know, high-minded constitutional principles that we call education, and 49% of what we do is attack ads against politicians, and therefore nobody can know who gave us hundreds of millions of dollars, and not only that, they're tax exempt. And the other thing about tax exempt organizations, Danette, is that you and I are subsidizing them. I mean, we're all subsidizing the entire country in some tiny way, is subsidizing everything from that children's village up in New Hampshire to the church down the street. Any nonprofit organization that is exempt from federal taxation is typically also exempt from things like local property taxes. And so we're paying for their fire. We're paying for their police protection. We're paying for their share of the commons. And I have a real problem with paying for Karl Rove's share of the commons. And, or for that matter, for President Obama having a PAC and paying for his share of the commons. I mean, although his PAC is much, or the one affiliated with his campaign is much smaller than what Karl Rove has got, I just don't think there should be any of them. I think that we should be looking at the IRS code. It says very clearly, social welfare organizations, these are things like where I'm broadcasting from. I'm broadcasting right now from Goddard College. It's a nonprofit organization. It's a tax-exempt nonprofit organization. That's what the tax code, when they wrote this tax code back in the day, they envisioned. And nobody envisioned Karl Rove, but when Citizens United came down the road and the nine monarchs in our new constitutional monarchy on the Supreme Court decided that they were going to invent a law that didn't exist, and a doctrine that didn't exist, that money is not property, it is speech. When they did that, when they said that, yes, there was a sudden explosion of applications. John Dean on our program a little earlier said it was over 70,000 of them from groups saying to the IRS, hey, I want to get in on this action and have the people support me and all this kind of thing. And the worker bees at the IRS were overwhelmed because the Republicans in Congress would not increase their budget, would not let them hire new people. In fact, sequestration, they're cutting back. And so they said, okay, how do we figure out which groups are, you know, schools, colleges, communities for abused kids, hospitals, homeless shelters, and how do we figure out which groups might be not social welfare organizations? Well, if their name is Tea Party Patriot, they might not be a social welfare organization. And they were getting thousands of applications for Tea Party Patriot groups because the Koch brothers and Dick Armey, they're funding this stuff like crazy all over the country. And so I'm with you, Jeanette. I think that the worker bees at the IRS were simply trying to look for a way to deal with an unusually high workload. And apparently they only did it for a few months where they were flagging words like Tea Party and Patriot. And so then people say, well, why didn't they flag liberal groups? Liberal groups tend to have names like the Wilderness Society or, you know, Feed the Elderly Incorporated or Meals on Wheels. And I think those are typically social welfare groups. So, Jeanette, thank you for the call. I think you're absolutely right. I think there's no there. This is not a scandal.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
More of Anything Goes Friday. Your calls, my comments, the news of the day right after this, 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Lisa in Honolulu, Hawaii, you disagree with me about the Supreme Court?
Yeah. So I just wanted to shed a little bit of light because I get a little frustrated when people boil down the whole Citizens United case into one soundbite, which is that corporations are people. And
money is speech.
Right, but have you read the case?
I not only have read the case, I wrote a book about the case. I've read the case, I've given speeches on the case, and if you're going to say that they didn't say money, corporations are people, you're right, it doesn't explicitly say that. Although in the dissent, you'll notice that Stevens comes right out and says that my colleagues are essentially saying that corporations are people.
That's not my issue. My issue is more with that the main purpose of the decision and the reasons that they came to it, and actually what the decision was about is what's totally missed on people. It's about political speech.
corporations being deemed as people or even having a right to political speech has been something that's been settled for like 30 years. And well, what Citizens United...
Arguably 100 years, but yeah.
Okay, well, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned and whether or not it's a constitutional right to that speech. So what I would really love for, you know, the political talk guys to do is to really dig into and educate people as to what the problems of the outcome of this case was, which is that Congress needs to get its act together and put together a comprehensive bill that will withstand Supreme Court and constitutional scrutiny. And the problem is that what they came out with was conflicting rules. So since 1978 with, it was like First United Bank versus Bilotti, they said that corporations, political speech and protections of political speech, which is like the highest protection of all of our, you know, First Amendment rights is political speech,
right,
that applies to corporations. And that kind of came about because it was connected with other things in the law of campaigns reform back then.
That came about because the First National Bank, Massachusetts had a law that said that corporations, and it might have been limited to banking corporations, I don't recall, it's been a decade since I read that case, but that that there was a law in Massachusetts that said that a corporation cannot put money into political campaigns unless it's an issue that directly involves them. And the First National Bank of Boston had gotten involved in a political campaign that did not involve banking. And so Frank Bilotti, the secretary of, or the, what do you call it, the chief law enforcement officer for the state, the attorney general, went after them, and this got taken to the Supreme Court. And you're right, the Supreme Court in First National Bank versus Bilotti said that the bank was that the corporation was recognized as a person under the law and therefore had First Amendment rights or had the right to political speech. It followed on Buckley versus Vallejo. You can take it all the way back to Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad in 1886. Or if you really want to get serious about it, you can take it back to Dartmouth versus U.S. back in 1815. But I think all of them, A, are wrongly decided. This doctrine that corporations have standing under the Constitution as persons is something that has never, ever been passed by any legislature anywhere. This is a wholly invented doctrine by the Supreme Court. And nowhere in the Constitution does the Supreme Court have the authority to make law, to create doctrine even. In fact, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution explicitly says that the Supreme Court, and Hamilton referred to this at some length in Federalist Number 78, saying, you know, they command no army, they have no police force, they have basically no power, they're the least likely to cause injury of the three branches of government, the weakest of the three. Article 3, Section 2 says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulations specified by Congress. So, you know, but no, the Supreme Court rose up in 1803 in Marbury v. Madison and said, no, we can strike down laws that we don't like. And you know, Jefferson went nuts when that case came down. He said, if this
constitutional, is what they said. We will decide what is constitutional. And
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. When they struck down the Judiciary Act of 1789 and in Marbury versus Madison in 1803. And Jefferson said, if this decision stands, then indeed the Constitution has become a thing of wax to be molded in the hands of an unelected judiciary. He said the Constitution has become a felo de se, a suicide pact.
Before Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court was kind of a joke. And their power.
They weren't a joke. They were the court of last appeals. And by the way, they you know, between Marbury versus Madison and Dred Scott in 1856, they did not again make a decision on the constitutionality of anything. They went back to deciding which dog ate which chickens. I mean, they were the final court, the final arbiter of disputes between people and whether the modern court reform pretty much didn't exist back then, but between people and businesses and states.
That was deciding a decision about that was a decision about what are states' rights, what are, you know, because it was a conflict between states. So the Supreme Court does have jurisdiction over that. They don't just make up laws willy-nilly. But I mean,
well, they do.
Going back to Citizens United,
in Citizens United, I would say that they did make up a law.
But when you say that the case came out and that the main point was that corporations are now considered people, you're actually hanging the whole entire, you're actually kind of washing over the whole case and its importance.
But the rationalization that they used, and Elisa, if you've read the case, you know this, the rationalization that they used was that we, the people, have the right to hear, and that's the same thing as speech. And corporations are the most well-informed about economic issues, and so by depriving corporations of the right to speak, we're depriving ourselves of the right to hear, and therefore we're limiting free speech. That was the majority opinion, the 5-4 decision. And that, to me, is the most twisted pretzel logic that I've ever heard. And Stevens called that out. I'm assuming you've read the dissent.
Yes. And what I'm saying is that I don't think you need to hang your hat on the dissent of that corporations are people. I think the bigger point is that Congress needs to come up with with the wording. That oftentimes they write laws that are way off, that they're just, the wording is awful. And it's the same.
Okay, I don't disagree with you. And in fact, I think Congress needs to do two things. One, in the 8-1 part of that decision, they said, why don't Congress make laws requiring transparency?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So Congress needs to pass a law requiring transparency and doing away with 501c4s. And number two, Congress needs to regulate the Supreme Court and say, sorry, you can't say that money is speech anymore. Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from WGDR, Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, where we're kicking off the Alternative Media Conference tomorrow. For more information, go to goddard.edu. It should be a fine and fun time. So the discussion about Citizens United, I rant about that so often, I'm not going to belabor it. Let's just move along. Paul in Benton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. What I was wondering about is, with all this obstructionism to the president's appointments and to his legislative agenda, why doesn't he use the bully pulpit and call out these Republicans? And also, I have some news from the labor front here in Pennsylvania.
Okay. What's the labor news?
David Millard, Republican from Berwick, has sponsored a bill to abolish prevailing wage laws in Pennsylvania.
Oh, jeez. Prevailing wage laws, of course, are the laws that I'm assuming in the case of Pennsylvania are like the federal law that requires state-funded projects to go to contractors that pay the prevailing wage, which is typically the union wage, which is typically a livable wage, rather than to contractors that hire people for minimum wage, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, and they want to do away with that. That's insane. I mean, this is incredible, insane Republican race to the bottom, and it is destroying this country. As to your question about why Obama won't use the bully pulpit, I honestly don't know. I mean, I have been watching this for 4 years. I keep waiting for him to kick into Harry Truman mode and start calling these guys out. And every now and then you get this little flash of anger and him saying there's no there. And I was astounded. Maybe because he doesn't think the media will pick it up, and maybe they won't. I mean, you had, when Eric Holder was testifying before Daryl Issa, 3 days ago? Maybe 4 days ago, 3 or 4 days ago? I think it was 3 days ago on Tuesday. You had Daryl Issa literally say, Congressman, the way you are behaving is shameful and not worthy of a congressman, or words to that effect. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he called him shameful, and he said that he was not worthy of a congressman. His behavior is not worthy of a congressman. And that should have been the headline in the New York Times. I mean, that was that, Joe Welch takes on Joe McCarthy moment. You know, Senator, at long last, have you no shame, Senator? That took down Senator Joe McCarthy, and Eric Holder said the words that could have taken down Daryl Issa, and it got absolutely no press coverage. You had to poke around on progressive sites like Raw Story or Talking Points Memo to find. In fact, TPM did the video of it. Everybody else completely ignored it. It just completely blew my mind. So it may be that he knows that, you know, we no longer have a free media in the United States. We have a corporate media, and they're not. Or it could be that that he's timid. I don't have a reason. I don't have an excuse, and I don't have a defense. I think he should be out there taking names and kicking ass, and he's not doing it, and I'd like him to start. Thank you very much for the call. James, hang on just a second here. James in Reno, Nevada. Hey, James, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I do, just fine.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller. I'm a member of 24 Hour Fitness, and it's an athletic club.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you've heard of it.
I have, yeah. I've seen their ads.
Okay.
Heard their ads.
Well, a couple of years ago, they started there's this new system. In order to get in, you have to give your fingerprint.
Yeah, my gym does the same thing.
Okay, does that bother you, or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been fingerprinted before. I mean, I was fingerprinted when I was a teenager, when I was arrested, you know, demonstrating. No, it doesn't particularly bother me. On the one hand, it's kind of creepy. On the other hand, you know, when Louise and I go to the gym, it's really convenient to just, you know, touch my finger to that little glass thing and the door unlocks and I can walk through and there doesn't have to be anybody there. I think, you know, increasingly we're seeing this biometric, use of biometrics as a way of identifying people. I'm assuming, you know, I look through their contract, their terms of use, and it doesn't say anything about having the right to sell my fingerprint to anybody, but, you know, our Fourth Amendment protections of privacy, the Fourth Amendment does not protect us from corporate snooping and corporate invasions of our privacy. It protects us from government snooping and government invasions of our privacy. So does it bother you? Does it concern you that your gym has your fingerprint?
Yeah, like it's a copy of a piece of your body, I guess you could say.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, when the doctor draws blood, you know, they have those records. They have details of you that are far more detailed than your fingerprint. And in some cases, they even have, you know, some of them will even assert the right to profile your DNA and sell it to labs and use it and, you know, do experimentation and things. I mean, this has been litigated repeatedly, and the corporations always win on this. What we need, in my opinion, is stronger laws to protect us and with regard to privacy from corporations. Although I personally don't consider, you know, my gym using my fingerprint as an invasion of my privacy. If they were selling my fingerprint, I would be very upset about that. Although I don't think anybody, you know, fingerprints are things that are typically used by government to determine crimes. And I don't think that there's a much of a commercial need or use for fingerprints. Can you think of one?
Just the fact that if they've got these files of fingerprints, and they've got it, and it's there, and then somehow they could put your fingerprint. If somebody doesn't like you, they put your fingerprint on somebody's window, and then they say, oh, this guy broke into your house or whatever.
But if somebody wanted to do that, all they'd have to do is follow you around and wait until you drink a glass of water and set the glass down in a restaurant and then walk by and scoop up the glass and take your fingerprint off that. Our fingerprints are everywhere. You know, they're if somebody wants to get them and use them maliciously, you know, in some way that's like, you know, a murder mystery on TV, it's not going to be hard. They don't have to go to a corporation to buy them. I think that there are genuine concerns about privacy that we should be worried about. And the main one, I think, is tracking us on the internet, tracking every action that we take. You know, when Louise was diagnosed with breast cancer and started going through her therapy and stuff, she was doing constant Google searches. She's become, you know, the most informed expert I know on the topic of breast cancer. And what happens wherever she goes, if she logs into a computer pretty much anywhere and logs into like the New York Times or any of these sites that use these advertising bots, ads pop up for things that breast cancer patients would use and, you know, wigs for chemotherapy or whatever. And it's like, that's creepy. And you know, you just, you know, thank God she's not, we don't use a lot of public computers, so, you know, she hasn't been horribly embarrassed by this, but, you know, can you imagine if she was surfing porn sites or something? I mean, there was actually a case of a young woman, this was in the news a couple of months ago, a young woman who had gone to her doctor and her doctor had to find out if she was pregnant. And this was a girl who was like 16 or 17 years old. The doctor determined that she was pregnant and sold that information, the buyer of that information. And so before she even finds out that she's pregnant, she's got an email or some kind of an ad or something in the mail that her parents got before she got, offering baby formula or baby toys or something like that. I mean, that kind of stuff, this corporate invasion of our privacy for the purposes of profit, I find, frankly, much more creepy and much more a fundamental violation of my right to anonymity than the idea that somebody someday may want to try and set me up for a crime, if that makes sense, James.
So. Call another time, but this separate issue was the are we allowed to give as much money as we want to a candidate, and any corporation can give as much money as they want to a candidate of their choice?
No, you can't. The limitations to individual candidates are still limited by law, and Citizens United didn't do away with that. What it did was it allowed PACs, political action committees, and super PACs to be set up that can work on behalf of a candidate. And so you can't give money directly to the candidate in an amount over, I think it's $2,200 now, but you can give, you know, $1 million to their PAC, and then, you know, they're off to the races. So, James, thanks for the call. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The reason I'm calling is because before the break at 4 o'clock or 5 the last hour break, you mentioned a travesty about all the joblessness in our country. Over to about maybe 20 to 25 million people are underemployed or unemployed. And yet, with this S-744 Gang of Eight bill, the so-called comprehensive immigration reform, right, if they pass this the way that it is right now, it's going to bring in 30 more million foreign legal workers in the next 10 years. And how can we be serious about...
I know. Bernie closed our first hour by pointing that out. He said next week immigration is going to come before the Senate. I'm very concerned about the fact that it's going to open the floodgates for skilled workers to come into the United States and displace American employees. Now, what we need to do is be pushing back. You need to be calling your two senators and your member of the House of Representatives, and, you know, writing blog posts and writing letters to the editor of the newspaper and, you know, everything else you can to say, you know, this H-1B visa and all these other kinds of visas that allow corporations to hire cheap foreign labor in the United States need to be done away with. Take them out of the immigration bill. They have got nothing to do with it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's amazing when something that is, you know, arguably as noble as the DREAM Act and as practical as the immigration bill turns into a corporate welfare program. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Michael in Canton, North Carolina. Fingerprints at work?
Yeah. I found out about this. I decided I was going to use my middle finger.
Well, I got to tell you, at our health club, they ask you to use your middle finger. And which totally baffled me. I'm like, why is that? And Louise's middle finger wouldn't read, so they ended up using her thumb. But I give them the middle finger. Literally, I put my middle finger on the little glass thing every time I go in there. So, yeah, in fact, Louise and I, when we first signed up, I was like, middle finger? Really? I guess it's the biggest, you know, pad on your hand outside of your thumb, and it doesn't get as much use as the index finger, so it's probably less likely to be worn away or something, but I thought it was particularly ironic. Thanks, Michael. Mike in Waukegan, Illinois, listening to WCBT. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom, how you doing?
Yeah, great.
I'd like to address that caller you had on the air during the brunch with Bernie period there. He called up and he advocated a fine of $2,000 for minors or people, I guess, caught with marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'd just like to kind of counter that. It's easier for minors to purchase banned substances than vice versa, because street dealers really aren't that particular who they deal to.
Yeah.
And fines.
I would suggest that the extent to which the minority communities have been ravaged by drugs, it's just like they were by alcohol during prohibition. That's the consequence of the prohibition and the consequence of 400 years of institutionalized racism in North America. And, we need to deal with the racism. We need to deal with the jobs problem. We need to deal with the unemployment. We need to deal with poverty. And we need to end Nixon's drug war. And when we do those things, then I think the minority communities will start to unwind, these problems.
Yes. The fines would just cause more poverty in an already impoverished community. In a Catholic catechism, I think this is very cogent here. It says that it's an unjust interference with individual liberty to forbid all men to drink, even in moderation, because a few take it to excess. And I think you could exchange the word drink there with just about any substance, I would think.
Yeah.
Why should they intoxicate themselves?
Yeah, just say intoxicate themselves. I mean, we did just fine in the United States from 1789 when the Constitution was ratified. We became a modern country. From 1789 until the 19-teens, we did just fine with pot growing and opium growing and coca growing, and you could walk into a drugstore and you could buy Coca-Cola, which was made with cocaine. That's why it's called Coca-Cola. And there were some people who became drug addicts or Lydia Pinkham's tonic or whatever, but most people didn't. And, now we've decided to limit it, the drugs that we can abuse, to alcohol and tobacco. And it's like, why did we pick the two most destructive drugs to say we're going to limit, it to that? It's because they're the most profitable, I guess. But, Mike, your point is really not well made. Thank you for the call. Tony in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thanks.
Quick question. Supreme Court justices, are they going to is there one or two up here under Obama? And what's going to take to get the power control over the Democratic side?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is elderly and has had cancer several times, so there is concern that she might retire, or God forbid, something might happen to her. She's, I think, a really, really good justice. She's one of arguably the most progressive justice on the court. If she goes and Obama replaces her, then the balance of the court does not change. Justice Kennedy is also elderly. He's in his mid to late 70s, and he's appearing increasingly frail. And he's the swing vote. He's the one who has been the guy who threw in with the four hardcore right-wingers and always went along with them. And so, if he retires or dies, and I'm not wishing that on him, this is the only way people get out of the Supreme Court, because they're royalty. They live, they rule for life. And if he does and Obama replaces him with somebody like Sonia Sotomayor or Elena Kagan, then the court will change its composition. The 5-4 will flip on to the progressive side. And then a lot of damage that this court has done can be revisited and remedied, including Citizens United. Although, frankly, I would rather see Citizens United fixed by we the people passing a constitutional amendment than by the court unwinding their own things.
And what about term limits on those guys and possibly age limits?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1937, proposed that anyone over 70 years old, that all of the justices over 70 years old in aggregate would end up with one vote. They would all be called justices emeritus. And at that time, there were, I believe, four justices on the court who were over 70. And that would have meant that he could add three justices to the Supreme Court. And he was doing this because up until 1936, the Supreme Court was declaring unconstitutional things like the minimum wage and the 40-hour work week and workers' right to strike and things like that. Social Security was at risk. He had arguably the power to do that. There's some very good scholars who think that had he persisted, he actually could have gotten that passed through law. But the court was so intimidated by him that they backed out and they stopped knocking down his laws. so, and they started going along with the New Deal in 37, even though the composition of the court didn't change. I would love to see Obama have that kind of spunk or chutzpah or whatever, but it doesn't seem to be in the cards. Anyhow, that's it for today. Thanks a lot for joining us. We're at Goddard College tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock, or 9 o'clock, actually. I'll be giving a keynote talk here. Ellen Ratner will be wrapping it up. Goddard.edu for more information. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get involved. Get out there to movetoamend.org or pdamerica.org or free-don.com. Tag your it. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.